Hey, this is Hal Hester. I'm the pastor of Vineyard Christian Church, and this is our podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today. I hope this message inspires you, builds your faith, and gives you perspective on how God is moving in your life. Please enjoy the message.
Well, for those of you who don't know me, my name is April. Pastor Hal has asked me to speak while he is enjoying some much-needed time away, so I am very honored to be here with you this morning and share with you today. In November of 2017, while I was still working as the youth pastor here at the Vineyard, our church staff went away for a three-day leadership conference, and it was a really busy time of life for me, trying to be a working mom while taking care of a toddler, in the process of buying a new home, all while being 6 months pregnant. And I got to that point where it was getting a little hard trying to balance it all. And I'll never forget leaving for that conference as I was pulling out of the driveway and I looked in my rearview mirror of my little baby boy who's 2 years old, reaching his chubby little hand out to mine, screaming, "Mommy, please don't go." And my heart was crushed. And I remember looking at him getting smaller and smaller as I drove off. And I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. My heart just wanted to be home with him. And in that moment, that's when I knew it was time to step away from work and be home with my kids. And since then, God has been transitioning me and teaching me a lot. As he has been pulling me out of the deep end of full-time ministry and now has dropped me into the kiddie pool of mom life. And if I can be real with you, that transition was a lot harder than I had expected. I thought teenage drama was a challenge until my two-year-old became a three-nager. And anyone who lives through that knows what I'm talking about. It's not always fun. I asked my husband just the other day, I said, how can so much attitude fit in such a small body? He just looked at me and said, sometimes I wondered the same thing. I'm like, oh boy, I set myself up for that one. But what I quickly discovered in my new role as being home as a mom and taking care of my family is that my identity was being shaken. I was feeling a little lost because I no longer held a title, no longer brought home a paycheck. And I kind of had to find out, like, who am I? When you're busy all throughout the day taking care of other people, doing this, cleaning that, going here, you can almost feel like a part of you is lost. And in this new role, I could feel my self-worth just being targeted. You know, because in a job, you get to dress nice, right? You get to feel important. People listen to you. You get to see the benefits of your hard work. But when you're wiping butts, trying to reason with a toddler, and find pieces of food in your hair, it's hard to see your value in those moments, right? Because it's not always glamorous. But it's important because they're important. And sometimes you have to learn that the hard way. I remember one morning actually getting up and looking around my house as if like raccoons had gotten loose by the amount of crumbs all over the floor, dishes up in the sink, clothes that were just thrown everywhere. And I, in my overwhelmed state of panic, lost it. I snapped at my husband. I snapped at my kids because something inside of me thought, is this it? Is this really what I was made for? To be a merry maid who isn't feeling very merry today? And isn't it just like the enemy to take your biggest blessings and use them as a way to wear you down? Use them as a way to whisper lies that would combat against your identity and purpose. And in that moment, graciously yet sternly, the Lord revealed to me, this is your calling. It's not about the tasks around you. It's about the lives before you. And I remember standing there in my laundry room just like, God, you're so right. That was such an awful thing to think. But my whole perspective started to shift. I began to ask God to reveal to me his view and his purpose, because I know that things that he's a part of don't just affect the here and now, but in the moments to come, the generations to come, and in his kingdom to come, and he wants us to be a part of it. But sometimes it's hard to zoom out of our everyday life, you know, when we're busy and stressed out with 1,000 things to do. But if we can just imagine for a moment that there is so much more beyond us that's going on. That God in his infinite wisdom is at work colliding his will to the details of our lives. And what he desires are hearts that will love him enough to give him complete control to use every situation as a platform for his presence to be known. And when we know who we are and why we're here, it gives us a deeper sense of direction and meaning, even in the smallest things. And so if you guys were here last week, Jason spoke on identity, and he listed some things that we may view ourselves as or get caught up in, and most of them were literally just everyday struggles. The things that were hard to let go of, he kind of referred to as green sweatshirts, something in his life that was really hard to let go of. And so this morning, I would like to just give a little bit of a visual explanation of what I think that might look like for us. And so for some of us, we have faced rejection. And this is where the enemy rejoices, and when we allow the circumstances around us to shape who we are. He loves nothing better than to take the things that have been done to us to tear us apart, to make us feel invaluable. And so the first thing that we're going to talk about right now is just rejection, and how if we aren't accepted by others, then we must be unwanted. Has anyone else ever felt that way before? Okay. Actually, I'll go over here. We'll start with rejection. Second one, and these are kind of all insecurities that can rise up in us, is injustice, right? When we are mistreated, we feel sometimes like we're not loved. If things that happen to us unfairly, it just must be because we deserve it, because we're really not loved. This one hit home for me because as the list was going on last week in the sermon notes, he said, you know, you can go ahead and underline anything you think you might struggle with. And I'm like, oh, is there enough ink in this pen? I'm trying to underline all the stuff. I'm like, hopefully no one sees this really all what I struggle with. So I just thought I'd announce it this morning. So pride is a big one for me. If anyone has come with this, it's hard to ask for help because we can do it. We don't need you, right? Pride also makes us feel powerful sometimes when other people are struggling. We're like, yes, we're doing okay. You know, like, it's a hard thing, and the enemy loves pride. He loves when we can get wrapped up in that. It's like his playground. Another one that's hard to let go of. Whew. Control. Who's going to hold the remote tonight, right? It's a hard thing to give up, especially if you're OCD and everything has to have an order. You know, don't even get me started. But when we view these things in our lives, when we allow these circumstances that we are in to shape who we are, it kind of gets this teeter-totter mentality that when things around us are good, we feel good. And when things around us go downhill, get bad, we go downhill, we feel bad. And you know what the product of that mindset is? Miserable people. Miserable people who are never satisfied because the life around them is up and it's down, so they're up and they're down. But thank God that we don't have to rely on the opinions of others to define who we are or situations around us, because our identity has already been established and our purpose has already been revealed. Ephesians 2:10 kind of sums it up pretty well. It says this, "For we are his workmanship, his masterpiece, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." The God of the universe calls you his masterpiece. Like, that's no child refrigerator art right there with like 12 eyes and, you know, hands coming from every direction. And you're like, oh, is that an airplane? No, Mom, that's you. Oh, okay. Yeah, I totally saw that. Sure. That's not what God's talking about here. He's talking about you as a masterpiece. That doesn't just happen. It has to be thought out, designed for a specific reason and brought to life. And here it says that we are created in the image of God's Son to fulfill the work that he has set out for us. Man, what an honor and a responsibility that is. So what would that even look like? So I'm kind of going to give us a visual this morning, and I want you to imagine it like a tapestry, okay? Through every situation we face, God is weaving a bigger story, but we can only see the backside, right? the backside where there's like frayed ends, big clunky knots, and it kind of looks like a jumbled mess, right? I mean, I wouldn't frame that in my house above my family's picture, would you? It's kind of abstract. And who knows, maybe someone would pay millions for it. But it doesn't make sense, right? So if this is our lives and this is all that we can see, we can either A, trust God knows what he's doing and go along with it, or B, we can fight every stitch that doesn't fit the pattern of our plans. But it's not until that tapestry is turned over that you get to see the whole picture. The beautiful handiwork of God that has now been revealed. Every vibrant color, detail, and difficult stitch, now seeing it come together from a different angle, finally makes sense. But until that day come where our tapestries are completely revealed, we live like woven threads. Not seeing the full picture God is weaving, but trusting the process for his glory to be revealed. And if there's one person who lived that out well, it's the life of Joseph. Now, usually Pastor Hal reads about one chapter at a time, but since he's not here this morning, we can do whatever we want. So I have taken the liberty to read the whole life of Joseph. But since his story kind of goes through chapter 37 through 50, I wanted you guys to keep your lunch plans, so no concerns. I'm going to do the same thing I do when my kid brings me, like, the largest book he owns with the smallest words and, like, read a page, skip a few, and then read another page. So you can hold on. It'll be good, I promise. Has anyone ever seen the movie Joseph, King of Dreams? Okay, I'm sure the story is very familiar if you've been around long enough. What about the play, is it called Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat? Anyone seen that play? Okay. All right. Where are my flannel graph survivors here? Anyone seen flannel graph Joseph in his 70s robe? Yeah, few. All right. That's how I learned the story at first. But I loved it because Joseph's story is such a story of hope that we can get a glimpse of what it looks like when God is weaving in the background and you start to see pieces of his tapestry revealed. And so it's so awesome this morning that I wanted to not just read a section here and there, but I kind of wanted to get the full picture of his story. And so as a recap, if you want to turn to Genesis 37 or swipe there in whatever electronic device you have, we're going to be starting in 37 and then moving on from there. But as a recap, it starts with a man named Jacob who has 11 sons, and he makes it very clear that his youngest son, Joseph, is his favorite, which caused a lot of jealousy to all the other kids who didn't get a fancy coat from dad. And it's things like this that keep therapists employed. You know, jealousy is a very, very real thing. And they say that the youngest child is usually favored by most parents. But I'm the youngest of four, and I can honestly say they are so right. My sister was here in the first service, so she got a kick out of that one. But Joseph was a dreamer, and he did not, it did not help the jealous factor at all by telling his brothers that one day they would bow to him. It actually enraged them so much that they took matters into their own hands. So if you would like to start with me in Genesis 37, we're going to start in verse 23. And so if anyone here has ADD, you came to the right place because we're going to be hopping all through Genesis today. All right, starting with verse 23. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore. And they took him and threw him into the pit. The pit was empty and there was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. There they took Joseph to Egypt. That is a cold-hearted band of brothers right there. All right, here they throw Joseph in a pit to die. Then instead of fleeing the scenes, they decide to break out their baskets and just have a picnic right here. Like, no big thing, right? Make a buck off of them. But I'm sure many of us here, if we took time to share horror stories of the things that our siblings have done to us, right? I mean, we could laugh for hours. There is no Brother of the Year award going on to any of them. And in this twisted plot, his brother even comes up to sound like a hero. And he says, it doesn't benefit us to kill him, so let's just, you know, sell him. Let's make a buck. You know, because after all, he is our brother. Like, dude, you're totally missing the point. You can't leave your brother to die and then look like the good guy. But I could imagine Joseph's disappointment as he's stuck in the pit, like in there probably praying, like, God, save me. Please give my brothers a change of heart. Deliver me from this pit. So excited when he gets lifted up, like, yes, God, I know you'd come through. But then realized he was only pulled out to be sold out by family. Yeah, that would sting. The first thing we're going to talk about is how he was faced with rejection. What would it feel like to you to have someone who's supposed to love you and care after you and look out for you send you to die? And so he had a choice that he could have made to let this fear of rejection completely destroy him. And so he got wound up. Wounding of feeling rejected. The question is, if God loved him, how could he allow something like that to happen? Why didn't he step in and do something? Haven't you gone through a situation where you thought those same things? Why didn't God step in? Why didn't he do something? Why would he like to see me hurt like this? But as we read on, we see that Joseph was not defined by his rejection. And just why God would allow something like that to happen. So we're going to continue reading in Genesis 39, starting at verse 1, going through 6. It says this. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian who had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there, the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in the sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and field. Man, talk about making good lemonade out of bad lemons here, right? If Joseph had been wallowing in self-pity or made himself the victim, like, why didn't God love me? I was just set in a pit to die. It doesn't matter what I do, right? If he had that attitude of just wearing his rejection on his sleeves, he would have completely missed this opportunity. But it's obvious in verse 3 why he became such a success. It says here, his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. See, even through his rejection, God didn't leave him for a moment. He stayed close, so close that his presence was evident through Joseph's faithfulness, his integrity, and his hard work, which led him to prosper as a slave to the overseer in Potiphar's house. But with every success story, there's always a little drama. So here's a part where I skip a few pages and just fill in the blanks. They don't mention a whole lot about Joseph other than the fact that they make it very clear he was a good-looking man. So much so that Potiphar's wife took notice of that. She was very attracted to him. And so she made multiple offers to Joseph that most men would not refuse. But Joseph made it clear he did not want to do anything that would go against God or his master. So he turned her down multiple times. Then she made up some lifetime movie drama stuff and just twisted this whole plot around and lied to her husband, told her husband it was actually Joseph who was trying to be unfaithful with her, and his master had no option but to throw him into prison. So now we can add to his therapy list not only rejection, but now injustice. When something happens to you that is unfair, that is not right, that you did not deserve. I don't know about you, but if that happened to me, like, I'd be mad to have your whole reputation ruined for something you never did. Have you guys ever been there before, where you felt like someone made up a lie or took what you said and twisted it? It's that feeling of injustice. I don't deserve this. And yet he was thrown into prison, facing that. Joseph's identity wasn't even shaken. Instead, he used prison as a center stage for God to do his thing. And so we're going to pick back up in Genesis 39, starting in verse 20, to see what went on after he was thrown in prison. It says this, "And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed." This is a testimony right here. Like, this is amazing at this point because it started off a little rocky, right? Here he gets thrown in a pit, left to die. Then he gets saved, only to be sold as a slave. Then he gets promoted, yes! And then he gets imprisoned. It's like this up and down roller coaster. By the time he gets excited, he's dropped back down again. I mean, has anyone else felt that before where you are getting through, you know, something, you finally overcome it just to face defeat again? Just to get knocked down. But then we see these words for the second time. The Lord was with him. I think David explains it best in Psalms 23, where he says, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For what? You are with me." Even through the darkest moments, God is with us. In 2009, our family refers to that time as the year that we faced great loss as four family members of ours passed away back to back to back. Some older who really couldn't fight anymore, some unexpected, but one so young she never got a chance of life at all. And during that time, I was in Europe. And I remember being so far away that I couldn't even fly home for some of the funerals. And that was really hard for me. That whole season of life, I was a wreck. The frailty of life became a strong reality. And so I began to cling closer to God than I ever have before. Because he's all I had. And that was one of the toughest years I had ever gone through. It just seemed like God was stripping things away from us left and right. But if there was ever a time I felt the closest to the Lord, it was during that time. It was during that season where I had no other choice but to cling close to God because I felt like my heart was just in pieces. And through that time, God was weaving his purpose in it all. He was using those moments of brokenness to secure those frayed ends of faith. And sometimes the more knots you have, the stronger you become. Because you can never compare religion, teachings, or time spent in a church building to the presence of God. Because when you bring to him those raw moments where you share your heart and you understand his, that's where peace is found. And that's where healing takes place. You see, Joseph was in prison for several years, and it was in the waiting that God was preparing him for what was yet to come. It was in the waiting that others witnessed what the power of God can do. And to show that you can't discredit the unlikely places and people you encounter, because there may just be a reason. There were two other prisoners that had dreams they couldn't make sense of. And because of the gift that God gave Joseph, he could. So one of the inmates was released back to be the cupbearer of Pharaoh, just like Joseph said he would. And he said to him, "Please remember me when you go back to see Pharaoh." But it wasn't until 2 years later that the man actually did, when Pharaoh had a dream that couldn't be explained. Like, I wish I had Joseph's gift of interpreting dreams, because some of my dreams are like crazy whacked out Stephen King novels, right? Where like I'm getting chased, I'm going to die. And then the alarm clock goes off with the baby screaming and I'm exhausted. Like, I've done a lot of work all night. This is crazy. Like, Joseph, where are you? Tell me what this means. So as we continue reading in Genesis 41, we're going to start back up in verse 14. And this is the process of what happens once Pharaoh had called for Joseph. So it says this, Genesis 41, 14. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. And so Pharaoh shared the dream that he kept having, and Joseph interpreted it. And so kind of as a nutshell, Egypt would have 7 years of great plenty in crops and in food supply, but then 7 years of severe famine that would completely deplete the land. And so if the food was portioned correctly, during those years of plenty, they would have enough stored for the 7 years of need. And as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, who would have known this unless they had insider information? Like, who would have known what would happen 7 years from now? Because you really can't just make that stuff up. And so Joseph's life right here is on the line, sharing what he thinks God spoke to him to Pharaoh. But here's what it shows, is just how close Joey was to the Lord. That when God spoke, he listened. And when the opportunity arose, he acted. And so we're going to continue reading as you flip over to Genesis 41, starting in 38, what happened after that. So Pharaoh asked them, can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God had made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. Woof! That's not a bad promotion, right? Going from a prisoner to royalty. But what I love is that Pharaoh wasn't impressed most with his great speaking abilities. He wasn't so impressed with his amazing knowledge here. But what did he notice first is that the Spirit of God was in him. Are you seeing a pattern here? Just like the Spirit of God was evident to Potiphar, the prison guard, and here now Pharaoh. And what stood out to me is that Joseph didn't allow defeat to define him. Rejection, injustice. He didn't allow his unfair circumstances to dim the light of God in him. Even through every dark moment, his faithfulness still shined through. And he's like that fly you try to kill, right? You swat it, think you got it down, and then it just starts buzzing again. You swat it again, goes down. You walk away, it just starts buzzing again. Like, this guy can't die. Nothing is keeping him back. It's that persevering faith that doesn't waver. It doesn't give up. And I think that's what Jesus desires of us when he said in Matthew 5:16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. But let's just take our church hats off for a second if we're allowed to do that. It's hard to keep that light shining when annoying people irritate us, right? I mean, or when we're mistreated, judged unfairly. Like, what about when it's the people closest to us, the ones in our home who know how to push every single button until we snap? Can our light still shine then? Because it's hard. It is so hard. But it's only when we allow the Spirit of God to use his supernatural strength in those moments to overcome us, so that we can react in a way that still brings him honor. Because let's face it, we may not be able to control the things that hurt us, but we can choose how we respond to them. And as the story continues, Joey finds himself in a very difficult position, and we'll see the outcome of how he chooses to respond to it. So as a recap, when the time came from the faraway lands who were coming in search of food during the famine, they came to Egypt where Joseph had it stored. And amongst the crowd, the moment happened where he saw his brothers for the very first time. For the first time since they left him in a pit to die. I can imagine at this point, like, I would have that grapefruit feeling stuck in your throat where it's hard to swallow. You're probably envisioning everything in your mind you thought you would do or say to them, and you're wrestling back and forth if you should or if you shouldn't. That knot in your stomach you get that makes your toes curl because you're so uncomfortable. He looks in the eyes of the ones who betrayed him, bowing down to him. Like, at that point, wouldn't you be tempted to, like, rub it in their face how successful you are and how desperate they look? Right? This is your perfect opportunity. Not to mention the fact they ended up bowing down to you like you once told them before they tried to, you know, send you out and kill you. But Joey didn't take the route of revenge or abuse the power for selfish gain like most would. Not gonna lie, that'd be tempting, right? You have the power. You have the position. Rub it in their face a little bit, right? But instead, he put their character to the test, and he did something only God can do. We're going to continue in Genesis 45, picking up with verse 4. It says this. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourself because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life." God sent me before you to preserve life. Does that sound like a man that's trying to get even? No, it sounds like a man who had already stepped back and seen parts of his tapestry revealed, and how God in his sovereignty took every loose and broken strand of his unjust circumstance, and he tied it together to complete the picture crafted for his will. And here still, it's evident that the Lord was with him in how he chose to forgive, because this was his perfect chance to leave them drowning in their guilt or plot a way to get even, and he didn't. Pride. Pride will swallow us whole. Pride has a way of enjoying seeing other people's fail so we can succeed. That was a temptation I'm sure he had. And the enemy wants nothing more than for us to entertain pride, because it will ruin our lives. But instead, he chose to forgive. And so what I want to read to you is just a story here in just a second. If any of you guys have heard of Corrie Ten Boom before, I learned about her as a small girl. She was a Christian Holocaust survivor in the Netherlands who was imprisoned with her family during World War II after being caught for hiding hundreds of Jews from the Nazi authorities. And it was a really tragic time for their family, I can imagine, because her father and sister, they never made it out alive through all that had happened. And after Corrie's release from that concentration camp in 1946, she became a traveling missionary, and she started sharing her story through power and forgiveness. And so here she writes these words from one of her books. I was just going to share it, but it means so much more coming from her lips or from the page. It says here, "It was a church in Munich that I saw him, a balding, heavy-set man in a gray overcoat, a brown felt hat clutched between his hands, and people were filing out of the basement room where I had just spoken. It was 1947, and I had come from Holland to defeated Germany with the message that God forgives. And that's when I saw him, working his way forward against the others. One moment I saw the overcoat and the brown hat, the next a blue uniform and a visored cap with skull and crossbones. And it came back with a rush, remembering those days, the huge room filled with its harsh, overheated lights, the pathetic pile of dresses and shoes in the center of the floor, the shame of walking naked past this man. I could see my sister's frail form ahead of me, ribs sharp beneath her parchment skin. "You mentioned Ravensbrück in your talk," he was saying. "I was a guard in there." No, he did not remember me. "But since that time," he went on, "I have become a Christian. I know that God has forgiven me for the cruel things I did there, but I would like to hear it from your lips as well." He held his hand out. "Will you forgive me?" And as I stood there, I whose sins had every day to be forgiven and could not. Betsy, my sister, had died in that place. Could he erase her slow, terrible death simply for the asking? It could not have been many seconds that he stood there, hand held out to me. But to me, it seemed like hours as I wrestled with the most difficult thing I ever had to do. For I had to do it, I knew that. The message that God forgives has a prior condition, that we forgive those who have injured us. And still I stood there with a coldness clutching my heart. But forgiveness is not an emotion. I knew that too. Forgiveness is an act of the will. And the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. "Jesus, help me," I prayed silently. "I can lift my hand. I can do that much. God, you supply the feeling." And so woodenly and mechanically, I thrust my hand into the one stretched out to me. And as I did, an incredible thing took place. The current started in my shoulder, raced down my arm, sprang into our joined hands. And then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole being, bringing tears to my eyes. "I forgive you, brother," I cried with all my heart. For a long moment, we grasped each other's hands, the former guard and the former prisoner. I had never known God's love so intensely as I did then. Can you imagine? What a testimony that can happen when we act on the truth of God's word instead of relying on our emotions. Have you ever experienced the presence of God like that before, where he has overtaken you in a moment, where your hurts and your rejection and your injustice just wants to spring out of you, and you close the lid and you pray and say, "God, I need you. I need you in this moment to overtake me, because everything inside of my flesh wants to do the opposite." You see, Corey saw firsthand what the power of hate can do to an entire people group. How evil the human heart of men can be. And yet what a perfect picture of the gospel. By extending love to someone and giving forgiveness to someone undeserving. Just like Jesus did for us. Forgiveness is proof that nothing is impossible with God. And she records in one of her books her sister Betsy's last words right before she passed away. Her sister said, "We must tell them that there is no pit so deep that he is not deeper still." I'm sure many of you in this room have faced hardships far beyond my understanding. I don't know your story or the things you have faced, but I do know that if there's anything that you can leave encouraged by today, it's that he is deeper still. He is deeper than the pit of rejection. He is deeper than the prison of injustice. And just like he was with Joseph through it all, he'll always be with you. The last thing we come to is control. Joseph had a choice to give God full control over his life. Because if we're honest, that is very hard. I am not one to give up control easily. And so this really got me, is that when we give control to God, when we let him take everything that we are, everything that we have, all the hurts that we have faced and we start to hand it over to Him, we get to see the beauty of what God can do in our mess. The mess that has made us feel unworthy, unloved, not good enough. The insecurities that change our behaviors because we're trying to prove we're something when we feel like we're nothing. And so what God wants is God wants the jumbled mess. He promises in His word in Romans 8:28, He says, "We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to His purpose." Not that life will always be good or that we will always feel good, but we trust as God's people who desire His purpose that He can take our mess. He can take anything and use it for His good. So why does He remove things from our life? Why does He allow us to face difficult situations or allow bad things to happen to good people? Short answer is, I don't know. All I know is that He is sovereign and we are not. My kid asks for ice cream all the time. Sometimes I find him sneaking it on the kitchen floor, elbows deep, just getting cream-faced, sitting there at me like, "What up, Mom?" I'm like, "It's 7 a.m. What are you doing?" Right? "Just having ice cream." You know what I do? Take it away. Now, ice cream's good. Don't get me going on that. Like, that is a food group. I am convinced of it, and it's one of my favorites. But it's the wrong timing for him to have what's good, and so I take it away. And you know what he thinks of me? He thinks that I'm mean. He thinks that I'm unfair and that I must not love him because he kicks and screams and has his own little temper tantrum for not letting me have ice cream at 7 a.m. But I do it out of love. And even though he doesn't understand that in the moment, one day he will. One thing that I do love about the Bible is that you can read people's life story and see how God was with them through it all. Like, you're thinking, of course he would come through. Like, why would they just trust him in that moment? Because we get to see how the ending comes out, right? But it's hard sometimes in our lives in that to remember that God is still weaving. He's still using these things for his purpose. Even though it doesn't seem good at the time, we can still trust him that he will make good out of it. And just like Joey, we saw where those detours and setbacks led him to. They led him to save an entire nation that would go on to impact history and the world that we live in today through one man's obedience and faithfulness to the Lord. See, the pits that we're in do not define us. They prepare us. They prepare us to rely on God's strength and not our own. They prepare us to minister to others who are facing similar situations. They prepare us to go to places that we would have never chosen to go ourselves. I am saying that as a girl who wound up in Brooksville. This was not the place I would have chosen. But God knew my future. God knew my path. And God put that on my parents' heart to move here as a 16-year-old girl. And I fought tooth and nail. I made it very clear to them I did not want to be here. But most importantly, what our pits prepare us for is they prepare us to experience a deeper understanding of God's presence and power in our lives. I'd like to read to you a poem that I found while doing my devotions the other morning. I found it very fitting for our topic today. And what's even more meaningful is knowing who wrote it. So I'll save that for later. The poem goes like this. "My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I cannot choose the colors he weaveth steadily. Oftentimes he weaveth sorrow, and I in foolish pride forget he sees the upper and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly will God unroll the canvas and reveal the reason why. The dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he has planned. He knows, he loves, he cares. Nothing this truth can dim. He gives the very best to those who leave the choice to him." Written by Corrie ten Boom. And so as we close this morning, I would just invite you to stand just wherever you are. I'm going to invite the prayer team just to come on forward. And I would just like to pray. I don't want to put any words in your mouth or to put anything in your mind, but I believe that you know the different yarns in your life. You know those things that you get wrapped up in. You know those things that you need to hand over to the Lord. And so I'm just going to ask God this morning if he would just to speak to our hearts and ask him to speak in a way that would bring the most impact to your life. Because we can sit here and we can, oh, that was such a great whatever, and we can leave. Or we can ask God to change in us and to give us direction of what he wants to do with us. And so after we're done praying, we're going to have a time of ministry. The lights will be down. There'll be music. I'm going to invite you if you want to get prayer, or you can just sit where you are. If there's someone that you're close with next to you or a stranger and just say, hey, can someone pray for me? Or you want to talk to someone, let that be your time. But if you need to go and you need to get your kids, feel free to. After we're done praying, that's totally up to you. So God, we just thank you so much, Lord, this morning. God, we thank you for just the way that you reveal yourself in sometimes the most peculiar ways. God, sometimes the situations that we're in, they don't feel good in the moment. Lord, those hurts that we have faced, those feelings that we have felt, God, you've been there with us. And so, Lord, this morning, we give you complete control. As hard as it is for me to let go of that, God, we give you control to come in here, Lord, to have your way and to work in us and whatever that may look like. And so, Father, we just ask right now for any heart that might be wrestling with needing hope. Lord, maybe wrestling with just trusting you because they're not seeing the full picture here. And so, Lord, I just ask you, God, will you come? Will you work in a way that only you can do? We give you permission. We thank you for your love and for your goodness. In Jesus' name, amen.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast today. And if you did, there's two things I'd love to ask of you. Number one, would you subscribe to our show? That way, the most recent podcast will be in your feed, ready for you when you are. And secondly, if this ministry has impacted you and you'd like to help us continue to reach others, you can click on the link in the description to give now.